Is Alan Smugger, and title of his presentation is "Soil Aggregate Pores Controlling Water Flux Rates and Retention of Microbes and Ions."
Thank you. You can see the title has changed just a little bit. I want to thank Nadia for the nice presentation. It gave us a perspective that we've been looking toward as well with real-time PCR. And I'll talk about that in a little bit. I want to acknowledge the co-authors here. Mustafa is not with us. He's home learning the qPCR, so we assume that he's going to be able to contribute that. Wusang Sewell is a microbiologist. Haiyan Chung is not here because she's a new mother since 2 weeks ago, but she did much of this work. Alexander Sasha Krivchenko is here with us today. She is a statistician, soil physicist. Joan Rowe is a microbiologist, and Alexander Tartakovsky is one of the external consultants here. He's from the Pacific Northwest National Laboratory and is developing some very unique smooth surface models we'll talk about here in a little bit. Some of the rationale behind this approach is to question the bio side of biophysics. We've heard quite a bit of how microbes, bacteria, E. coli move through soil. One of the missing links that we feel in the literature is how much of this manure-applied fertilizer truly does pose a risk as a health contaminant, especially if there's a very high mortality rate of some of this E. coli. Now, the biggest question we're seeing, at least I'm seeing or observing, as these papers are presented, is how much of these CFUs or perhaps even total qPCRs are viable versus deceased versus added versus reproduced microbes. So these are the questions that we're attempting to address. This is the first year of an extended research project, so you can look at this as a report in progress. But we've known for some time that land management processes certainly do influence the spatial distribution of pores within aggregates. And since our group has been looking quite a bit at how some of the micropores, the mesopores, are changing inside of specific aggregates, we thought we'd take the easy route and look at aggregates instead of soil pores. So we're examining the distribution, retention, the viability using the CFU initially of E. coli and how that changes as we add different components to different concentrations of E. coli to aggregates. Why did we choose aggregates? Well, they really are the focal centers of the biogeochemistry and the biophysics in the soils. So what I'm talking about today has nothing to do with bulk flow. We're very concerned of how much of the solution and how many of the microbes move into the interiors of these aggregates, and then how those pore geometries within, as we begin to study them more comprehensively and can begin to model these, how are these influencing some of the retention, the establishment, perhaps even reproduction, log phase growth of bacteria in a manner that we can understand and apply then to some of the equations you've seen today with regard to the soil physics, and we'll leave it up to the rest of you to expand those scales to the large profiles in the landscape. Just by way of brief history, we've seen in the literature that there's quite a bit of difference in the clay loams. We've seen some of that today, as well as the silt loams. These are two different types of soils from Ohio. And if we look at saturated KSATs through these, we see 16 to 18 to 20 some fold differences in the flow through of saturated flow through larger aggregates versus smaller aggregates. And of course, this is influenced quite a bit by the management, whether it's conventional tillage, no tillage, or forest soils. And it's different, of course, across soils. Other data has demonstrated that as we go, we put these aggregates through different dry wetting cycles. This has been in the literature for some time. It changes not only the strength of aggregates, but it changes the concentrations of carbon that move to the interiors of aggregates, and it seems to be in a gradient fashion, as you would expect. We applied the carbon C13 carbon to these aggregates in the form of sucrose, and this was a 37-day, five-cycle wetting and drying approach. If we looked at the T. riflip of the total microbial, fungal, as well as bacterial, we saw in the controls, the blue, the exterior regions where most of the microbes were, very few in the of these microbial communities were in the interiors. But as we went through a wet-dry cycle, we began to see there was movement toward the interiors. And of course, as we added the glucose, this was just precipitated into log phase growth, but again, move more microbes to the interiors. Johannes Lehmann has just published this recently with regard to where carbon is accumulating around the in the pore spaces around these dark areas. It doesn't show up with the lights here, but you can see that very little, very fine nanopores even have carbon accumulating in them. These are within or beyond the reach, of course, of microbes, perhaps even their enzymes, for decomposition and respiration. So as we look at what soil aggregates are all about, and we've spent a lot of time with synchrotron imaging in collaboration with other folks around the world. This happens to be a publication by Stefan Paeth et al. And using the DMA, 3DMA rock software, we can image these. We can go through all types of extraction, segmentations, networks, but we're very interested in how these network statistics are modified by specific management systems. There's still arguments of what's the best segmentation. We're not going to get into that, but just to demonstrate it again, you can't see perhaps as well, but if we look at the cross sections of a whole range of soils, we see quite a few differences in biopores when we are addressing the no-till grasses. If we look at the conventional till, the same soil, you see a lot different, but slice by slice, a lot of difference in the porosity. Here's one that confuses all of us, but it's in very, very informative, because if we look at the pore sizes larger than 4.5 microns, we simply have a volume full of what I would call little jelly beans, okay? And if we look at some of these that are 100, and look at the numbers of pores that are somewhere between 5 and 100 microns, you see a lot of discontinued, but a lot more pores, but many of these are disconnected. If we can compare that with the continuous grass, and again, cut out some of the fluff here if you wish, and begin to look then at the specific connectivities, we can begin to look at specific volumes within a soil aggregate and say, okay, here's the tortuous pathway, this red line. And these many tortuous pathways, of course, are outlined and look very simple here. They're curvilinear, perhaps, or curved in many respects. But if we look a little more closely, and this is a cartoon of what we're seeing, there is a whole range of pores that have different radiar diameter, and they're connected by a lot of throats, pore throats as they're called. Okay, so if we look at this bacteria, how it ever got there, perhaps it's through the screen and behind the screen. So it's moving down this pore that's large enough for bacteria. But we've got different colors here to emphasize this actually is on Wei Wang's poster that perhaps some of you have seen. It is these different colors perhaps could be different acidities, different pHs, different solution concentrations, different quantities of water, of gaseous oxidation reduction systems. And every one of these environments change the surface component of a bacterial surface, and certainly with respect to viruses. These surfaces of bacteria begin to change in their pK numbers, okay, and their dissociation constant with cations. So as this bacteria is moving through, it's very similar to what we've been hearing in today's symposium with regard to colloids, except it has a very high, what shall we say, plasticity with regard to how it's moving through these specific pores and how it changes. So in an earlier paper this week, we went through some details of how we identified specific movement, and this is a repeat for some of those of you that saw that, but we added different components of 50 microliters of 10 to the 4 E. coli. These E. coli, I might say, are the K12 C3000, which have specific parameters that we can use in the future to just identify those, and then, of course, identify qPCR. But as we begin to add these, and you can see the white lines here, how we cut these up, we begin to look at 16 components of these and ask the questions from the outer top layer to the inner layers and so forth. What percentage of this E. coli was recovered? And this is the bottom line. If we take the average of the quantities of E. coli that survived, or that we could at least extract immediately after we hydrated these E. coli, and or even had air dry and applied it, and then waited 4 hours to see if we saw an increase, which we did, there was a little higher survival, perhaps, of beginning the log phase of E. coli production. We know that we're not extracting 100% of these, but we don't know what the reproductive rate is. So on an average, roughly 68% of the E. coli survived and could be extracted. So the next step we went through is to develop this little glass bead matrix that we could put an aggregate in the middle of, or close to this porous sintered glass screen. And so we can now begin to apply a specific vacuum so that we could drain the pores of the larger 1 millimeter glass. That would have a certain quantity of E. coli. Then the E. coli that went into the aggregates we could extract at subsequent different extractions of negative, hectopascals. So we looked at retention time, carrier solution, and temperature as how that changed the recovery of the E. coli. Notice we had E. coli in the original stock. This was really a very nice, luscious source of carbon for these bacteria. And of course, we had 100% recovery as we went through the system without the soil. Then as we added the soil and we used a water buffer, a phosphate buffer to control pH, kept it somewhere in the neighborhood of 6.7, and we had some calcium sulfates, and we had some, and then used some calcium chlorides to reduce any electron acceptors that might be in this semi-aerobic or anaerobic situation. So we were asking the question: after 2 hours at 4 degrees Celsius, how did that change the recovery of the E. coli in the soil? Well, you see, we're somewhere around 70 initially. Apparently, it was still moving into the aggregates, so we had a recovery of perhaps 55. If we waited 2 hours at room temperature 25 Celsius, we either had more growth or similar kinds of extractability of these E. coli from that soil aggregate that was in the glass bead. Notice we're having a bit of variability here with the calcium chloride. We're still working out the details of why that may have occurred. It could just be the few number of replicates, or there might be some statistically significant differences here between whether it's a sulfate or it's a chloride. We also then asked the question, as we had the aggregate in there, and we would hydrate this aggregate from underneath, saturate it, drain it once, okay? Then we would apply these 10 to the fourth units of E. coli and ask the question, okay, how much is recovered from the controls, okay, without soil in them? Well, sometimes we had quite a bit just washed straight through, okay? And other percentage, well, what, 25% stayed with the beads. These are perhaps at those interfaces that we saw demonstrated here today with regard to colloids and circles. There's always a bit of water film there that will keep E. coli. But then we added soils, okay? This happens to be a soil aggregate from the conventionally tilled, so we've got three replications here, and there's quite a bit of variability. And these are just simple aggregates and that much variability in the laboratory. So I'm not surprised at all by some of the data you are presenting today of how difficult it is to be downstream in a profile somewhere and see two or three orders of magnitude difference in the E. coli. But as we look at these, it is kind of fascinating to say, okay, there's quite a bit of variability in the effluent here. In other words, most of the E. coli was absorbed by this conventionally tilled aggregate. Secondly, we had only, 30% was stayed in the aggregate in the glass beads. And we think the reason for that is this conventionally tilled has a lot of porosity. And the exposures on the surface of the aggregates, of course, will accept a lot more E. coli. If we look now at the native succession, where there's a lot more connectivity of pores, we see much more uniformity in much less exception, I'm sorry, much less absorption by the E. coli into the aggregate, but it's rather uniform all the way across. So the uniformity is there, but why we have less absorption, it could be threefold. It could be because some of those pores are still filled with the water, remembered we saturated earlier, and or perhaps there's some even air logging. So we've moved on then to chloride and asked the question, how many pore volumes do we need to saturate and extract to get this advective dispersive reduction on the same situation, okay, with soils in these bed of matrix of glass beads. Well, we saw that we could remove these out very quickly, at least through the first 3, 4, 5, sometimes 6 volume changes. So that's now taking us to the point of saying, looking at some of the publications that are in the literature, how much can we learn with regard to the nodal pore volume of these pores within the aggregates? How about some of the path lengths of these pores? We see that there are differences between the grass no-tilled and the conventional till. How about some of the throat restrictions between pores? And there are many, many other components that we would like to continue to measure. In fact, we're in the process now of putting together a set of experiments where we will, instead of just saturating the aggregate, we'll have 0, 25, 50, and 75% of the pores filled with water before we add the E. coli to them, because this is exactly what is found in the field. Not seldom are all pores in the soil filled with water, even, I guess, since that, 24 inches in 24 hours down in Georgia. But the point is, we got a lot of variability. And what Alex Tartakovsky is doing for us is, some of you may have read this in the VadoZone journal here a couple years ago, he has what is called a smooth particle hydrodynamics model. This is a viscosity-driven model, in contrast to surface charges, pore sizes, and so forth. So right now, these white particles are considered soil. I just labeled 2. This has gone through 2 wetting and drying cycles. And what I want to point out here, I was hoping to show you the model, but it didn't transfer across. What I wanted to show you out here is, if we look at the recent water that was added during the second rehydration, here's the new water. If we look at the previous water that was added, that's the light blue water. So some of that was drained out between the first and the second hydration. Okay. If we look at the amount of air that's in here, it's the blue, the dark blue. Now, what I want to point out here is, if we begin to look at where the old water is still at the soil surfaces, it's not surprising, because this was simply drained at somewhere in the neighborhood of 300 hectopascal. So there's still water film around each one of these soil particles. Now, as these soil particles come together, of course, we're going to see a lot of capillary water retained. The point is, this is a very good place to trap E. coli. And if this is filled, these are filled with solutions that are relatively high in carbon and nitrogen, we're going to see log phase growth within a few minutes to an hour. Okay, so I'm going to pause and just give acknowledgments to the funding agency of CSRS, Michigan Agricultural College, the LTER at Kellogg, and the Ohio Research and Development Center of Rick Warren. Thank you.
Okay. And the last speaker today is Changping Su, and title of his topic is Transport of Antibiotic-Resistant Escherichia coli in Soil and Sediment.